This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Night and Day by Virginia Woolf. Chapter 32. Nobody asked Catherine any questions next day. If cross-examined, she might have said that nobody spoke to her. She worked a little, wrote a little, ordered the dinner, and sat for longer than she knew, with her head on her hand, piercing whatever lay before her, whether it was a letter or a dictionary, as if it were a film upon the deep prospects that revealed themselves to her kindling and brooding eyes. She rose once, and going to the bookcase, took out her father's Greek dictionary, and spread the sacred pages of symbols and figures before her. She smoothed the sheets with a mixture of affectionate amusement and hope. Would other eyes look on them with her one day? The thought, long intolerable, was now just bearable. She was quite unaware of the anxiety with which her movements were watched and her expression scanned. Cassandra was careful not to be caught looking at her, and their conversation was so prosaic that were it not for certain jolts and jerks between the sentences, as if the mind were kept with difficulty to the rails, Mrs. Milvain herself could have detected nothing of a suspicious nature in what she overheard. William, when he came in late that afternoon and found Cassandra alone, had a very serious piece of news to impart. He had just passed Catherine in the street, and she had failed to recognize him.
"That doesn't matter with me, of course. But suppose it happened with somebody else? What would they think? They would suspect something merely from her expression. She looked,
he hesitated,
"like someone walking in her sleep."
To Cassandra, the significant thing was that Catherine had gone out without telling her, and she interpreted this to mean that she had gone out to meet Ralph Denham. But to her surprise, William drew no comfort from this probability.
"Once throw conventions aside," he began, "once do the things that people don't do,
and the fact that you are going to meet a young man is no longer proof of anything, except, indeed, that people will talk." Cassandra saw, not without a pang of jealousy, that he was extremely solicitous that people should not talk about Catherine, as if his interest in her were still proprietary rather than friendly. As they were both ignorant of Ralph's visit the night before, they had not that reason to comfort themselves with the thought that matters were hastening to a crisis. These absences of Catherine's, moreover, left them exposed to interruptions which almost destroyed their pleasure in being alone together. The rainy evening made it impossible to go out, and indeed, according to William's code, it was considerably more damning to be seen out of doors than surprised within. They were so much at the mercy of bells and doors that they could hardly talk of Macaulay with any conviction, and William preferred to defer the second act of his tragedy until another day. Under these circumstances, Cassandra showed herself at her best. She sympathized with William's anxieties, and did her utmost to share them. But still, to be alone together, to be running risks together, to be partners in the wonderful conspiracy, was to her so enthralling that she was always forgetting discretion, breaking out into exclamations and admirations, which finally made William believe that, although deplorable and upsetting, the situation was not without its sweetness. When the door did open, he started, but braved the forthcoming revelation. It was not Mrs. Milvain, however, but Catherine herself who entered, closely followed by Ralph Denham. With a set expression which showed what an effort she was making, Catherine encountered their eyes, and saying, "We're not going to interrupt you," she led Denham behind the curtain which hung in front of the room with the relics. This refuge was none of her willing, but confronted with wet pavements and only some belated museum or tube station for shelter, she was forced, for Ralph's sake, to face the discomforts of her own house. Under the street lamps, she had thought him looking both tired and strained. Thus separated, the two couples remained occupied for some time with their own affairs. Only the lowest murmurs penetrated from one section of the room to the other. At length the maid came in to bring a message that Mr. Hilbury would not be home for dinner. It was true that there was no need that Catherine should be informed, but William began to inquire Cassandra's opinion in such a way as to show that, with or without reason, he wished very much to speak to her. From motives of her own, Cassandra dissuaded him.
"But don't you think it's a little unsociable?" he hazarded. "Why not do something amusing? Go to the play, for instance. Why not ask Catherine and Ralph, eh?"
The coupling of their names in this manner caused Cassandra's heart to leap with pleasure. "Don't you think they must be," she began, but William hastily took her up.
"Oh, I know nothing about that. I only thought we might amuse ourselves as your uncle's out."
He proceeded on his embassy with a mixture of excitement and embarrassment, which caused him to turn aside with his hand on the curtain, and to examine intently for several moments the portrait of a lady, optimistically said by Mrs. Hilberry, to be an early work of Sir Joshua Reynolds. Then, with some unnecessary fumbling, he drew aside the curtain, and with his eyes fixed upon the ground, repeated his message and suggested that they should all spend the evening at the play. Catherine accepted the suggestion with such cordiality that it was strange to find her have no clear mind as to the precise spectacle she wished to see. She left the choice entirely to Ralph and William, who, taking counsel fraternally over an evening paper, found themselves in agreement as to the merits of a music hall. This being arranged, everything else followed easily and enthusiastically. Cassandra had never been to a music hall. Catherine instructed her in the peculiar delights of an entertainment where polar bears follow directly upon ladies in full evening dress, and the stage is alternately a garden of mystery, a milliner's bandbox, and a fried fish shop in the Mile End Road. Whatever the exact nature of the program that night, it fulfilled the highest purposes of dramatic art, so far, at least, as four of the audience were concerned. No doubt the actors and the authors would have been surprised to learn in what shape their efforts reached those particular eyes and ears, but they could not have denied that the effect as a whole was tremendous. The hall resounded with brass and strings, alternately of enormous pomp and majesty, and then of sweetest lamentation. The reds and creams of the background, the lyres and harps, and urns and skulls, the protuberances of plaster, the fringes of scarlet plush, the sinking and blazing of innumerable electric lights, could scarcely have been surpassed for decorative effect by any craftsman of the ancient or modern world. Then there was the audience itself, bare-shouldered, tufted, and garlanded in the stalls, decorous but festal in the balconies, and frankly fit for daylight and street life in the galleries. But however they differed when looked at separately, they shared the same huge, lovable nature in the bulk, which murmured and swayed and quivered all the time the dancing and juggling and lovemaking went on in front of it, slowly laughed and reluctantly left off laughing, and applauded with a helter-skelter generosity which sometimes became unanimous and overwhelming. Once William saw Catherine leaning forward and clapping her hands with an abandonment that startled him. Her laugh rang out with the laughter of the audience. For a second he was puzzled, as if this laughter disclosed something that he had never suspected in her. But then Cassandra's face caught his eye, gazing with astonishment at the buffoon, not laughing, too deeply intent and surprised to laugh at what she saw, and for some moments he watched her as if she were a child. The performance came to an end, the illusion dying out first here and then there, as some rose to put on their coats, others stood upright to salute God Save the King. The musicians folded their music and encased their instruments, and the lights sank one by one until the house was empty, silent, and full of great shadows. Looking back over her shoulder as she followed Ralph through the swing doors, Cassandra marveled to see how the stage was already entirely without romance. But, she wondered, did they really cover all the seats in Brown Holland every night? The success of this entertainment was such that before they separated, another expedition had been planned for the next day. The next day was Saturday. Therefore, both William and Ralph were free to devote the whole afternoon to an expedition to Greenwich, which Cassandra had never seen, and Catherine confused with Dulwich. On this occasion, Ralph was their guide. He brought them without accident to Greenwich. What exigencies of state or fantasies of imagination first gave birth to the cluster of pleasant places by which London is surrounded is a matter of indifference now that they have adapted themselves so admirably to the needs of people between the ages of 20 and 30, with Saturday afternoons to spend. Indeed, if ghosts have any interest in the affections of those who succeed them, they must reap their richest harvest when the fine weather comes again and the lovers, the sightseers, and the holiday-makers pour themselves out of trains and omnibuses into their old pleasure grounds. It is true that they go, for the most part, unthanked by name, although upon this occasion William was ready to give such discriminating praise as the dead architects and painters receive seldom in the course of the year. They were walking by the river-bank, and Catherine and Ralph, lagging a little behind, caught fragments of his lecture. Catherine smiled at the sound of his voice. She listened as if she found it a little unfamiliar, Intimately, though she knew it, she tested it. The note of assurance and happiness was new. William was very happy. She learned every hour what sources of his happiness she had neglected. She had never asked him to teach her anything. She had never consented to read Macaulay. She had never expressed her belief that his play was second only to the works of Shakespeare. She followed dreamily in their wake, smiling and delighting in the sound which conveyed, she knew, the rapturous and yet not servile assent of Cassandra. Then she murmured, "How can Cassandra?" but changed her sentence to the opposite of what she meant to say, and ended, "How could she herself have been so blind?" But it was unnecessary to follow out such riddles when the presence of Ralph supplied her with more interesting problems, which somehow became involved with the little boat crossing the river, the majestic and careworn city, and the steamers homecoming with their treasury, or starting in search of it, so that infinite leisure would be necessary for the proper disentanglement of one from the other. He stopped, moreover, and began inquiring of an old boatman as to the tides and the ships. In thus talking he seemed different, and even looked different, she thought, against the river, with the steeples and towers for background. His strangeness, his romance, his power to leave her side and take part in the affairs of men, the possibility that they should together hire a boat and cross the river, the speed and wildness of this enterprise, filled her mind and inspired her with such rapture, half of love and half of adventure, that William and Cassandra were startled from their talk, and Cassandra exclaimed, "She looks as if she were offering up a sacrifice. Very beautiful," she added quickly, though she repressed, in deference to William, her own wonder that the sight of Ralph Denham talking to a boatman on the banks of the Thames could move anyone to such an attitude of adoration. That afternoon, what with the tea and the curiosity of the Thames Tunnel and the unfamiliarity of the streets, passed so quickly that the only method of prolonging it was to plan another expedition for the following day. Hampton Court was decided upon, in preference to Hampstead, for though Cassandra had dreamt as a child of the brigands of Hampstead, she had now transferred her affections completely and forever to William III. Accordingly, they arrived at Hampton Court about lunchtime on a fine Sunday morning. Such unity marked their expressions of admiration for the red brick building that they might have come here for no other purpose than to assure each other that this palace was the stateliest palace in the world. They walked up and down the terrace four abreast, and fancied themselves the owners of the place, and calculated the amount of good to the world produced indubitably by such a tenancy. "The only hope for us," said Catherine, "is that William shall die, and Cassandra shall be given rooms as the widow of a distinguished poet." "Or," Cassandra began, but checked herself from the liberty of envisaging Catherine as the widow of a distinguished lawyer. Upon this, the third day of junketing, it was tiresome to have to restrain oneself even from such innocent excursions of fancy. She dared not question William. He was inscrutable. He never seemed even to follow the other couple with curiosity when they separated, as they frequently did, to name a plant or examine a fresco. Cassandra was constantly studying their backs. She noticed how sometimes the impulse to move came from Catherine, and sometimes from Ralph, how sometimes they walked slow, as if in profound intercourse, and sometimes fast, as if impassionate. When they came together again, nothing could be more unconcerned than their manner. "We have been wondering whether they ever catch a fish," or, "We must leave time to visit the maze." Then, to puzzle her further, William and Ralph filled in all interstices of mealtimes or railway journeys with perfectly good-tempered arguments, or they discussed politics, or they told stories, or they did sums together upon the backs of old envelopes to prove something. She suspected that Catherine was absent-minded, but it was impossible to tell. There were moments when she felt so young and inexperienced that she almost wished herself back with the silkworms at Stogden House, and not embarked upon this bewildering intrigue. These moments, however, were only the necessary shadow or chill which proved the substance of her bliss, and did not damage the radiance which seemed to rest equally upon the whole party. The fresh air of spring, the sky washed of clouds and already shedding warmth from its blue, seemed the reply vouchsafed by nature to the mood of her chosen spirits. These chosen spirits were to be found also among the deer, dumbly basking, and among the fish, set still in midstream, for they were mute sharers in a benignant state, not needing any exposition by the tongue. No words that Cassandra could come by expressed the stillness, the brightness, the air of expectancy which lay upon the orderly beauty of the grass walks and gravel paths down which they went walking four abreast that Sunday afternoon. Silently the shadows of the trees lay across the broad sunshine. Silence wrapped her heart in its folds. The quivering stillness of the butterfly on the half-open flower, the silent grazing of the deer in the sun, were the sights her eyes rested upon and received as the images of her own nature laid open to happiness and trembling in its ecstasy. But the afternoon wore on, and it became time to leave the gardens. As they drove from Waterloo to Chelsea, Catherine began to have some compunction about her father, which, together with the opening of offices and the need of working in them on Monday, made it difficult to plan another festival for the following day. Mr. Hilberry had taken their absence so far with paternal benevolence, but they could not trespass upon it indefinitely. Indeed, had they known it, he was already suffering from their absence and longing for their return. He had no dislike of solitude, and Sunday in particular was pleasantly adapted for letter-writing, paying calls, or a visit to his club. He was leaving the house on some such suitable expedition towards tea-time when he found himself stopped on his own doorstep by his sister, Mrs. Milvain. She should, on hearing that no one was at home, have withdrawn submissively, but instead she accepted his half-hearted invitation to come in, and he found himself in the melancholy position of being forced to order tea for her and sit in the drawing-room while she drank it. She speedily made it plain that she was only thus exacting because she had come on a matter of business. He was by no means exhilarated at the news.
"Catherine is out this afternoon," he remarked. "Why not come round later and discuss it with her? With us both, eh?"
"My dear Trevor, I have particular reasons for wishing to talk to you alone. Where is Catherine?"
"She's out with her young man, naturally. Cassandra plays the part of chaperone very usefully. A charming young woman, that. A great favorite of mine."
He turned his stone between his fingers and conceived different methods of leading Celia away from her obsession, which he supposed must have reference to the domestic affairs of Cyril, as usual. "With Cassandra," Mrs. Milvain repeated significantly. "With Cassandra."
"Yes, with Cassandra,"
Mr. Hilberry agreed urbanely, pleased at the diversion.
"I think they said they were going to Hampton Court, and I rather believe they were taking a protege of mine, Ralph Denham, a very clever fellow, too, to amuse Cassandra. I thought the arrangement very suitable."
He was prepared to dwell at some length upon this safe topic, and trusted that Catherine would come in before he had done with it.
"Hampton Court always seems to me an ideal spot for engaged couples. There's the maze. There's a nice place for having tea. I forget what they call it. And then, if the young man knows his business, he contrives to take his lady upon the river. Full of possibilities. Full."
"Cake, Celia?" Mr. Hilberry continued.
"I respect my dinner too much, but that can't possibly apply to you. You've never observed that feast, so far as I can remember."
Her brother's affability did not deceive Mrs. Milvain. It slightly saddened her. She well knew the cause of it, blind and infatuated as usual.
"Who is this Mr. Denham?" she asked.
"Ralph Denham,"
said Mr. Hilberry, in relief that her mind had taken this turn.
"A very interesting young man. I've a great belief in him. He's an authority upon our medieval institutions, and if he weren't forced to earn his living, he would write a book that very much wants writing."
"He's not well off, then," Mrs. Milvain interposed.
"Hasn't a penny, I'm afraid, and a family more or less dependent on him."
"A mother and sisters? His father is dead?"
"Yes, his father died some years ago," said Mr. Hilberry,
who was prepared to draw upon his imagination, if necessary, to keep Mrs. Milvain supplied with facts about the private history of Ralph Denham, since, for some inscrutable reason, the subject took her fancy.
"His father has been dead some time, and this young man had to take his place."
"A legal family?" Mrs. Milvain inquired.
"I fancy I've seen the name somewhere."
Mr. Hilberry shook his head.
"I should be inclined to doubt whether they were all together in that walk of life," he observed. "I fancy that Denham once told me that his father was a corn merchant. Perhaps he said a stockbroker. He came to grief anyhow, as stockbrokers have a way of doing. I've a great respect for Denham," he added. The remark sounded to his ears unfortunately conclusive, and he was afraid that there was nothing more to be said about Denham. He examined the tips of his fingers carefully.
"Cassandra has grown into a very charming young woman," he started afresh.
charming to look at and charming to talk to, though her historical knowledge is not altogether profound. Another cup of tea?
Mrs. Milvain had given her cup a little push, which seemed to indicate some momentary displeasure, but she did not want any more tea.
"It's Cassandra that I have come about," she began. "I am very sorry to say that Cassandra is not at all what you think her, Trevor. She has imposed upon your and Maggie's goodness. She has behaved in a way that would seem incredible in this house, of all houses, were it not for other circumstances that are still more incredible."
Mr. Hilbury looked taken aback, and was silent for a second.
"It all sounds very black," he remarked urbanely, continuing his examination of his fingernails. "But I own I am completely in the dark."
Mrs. Milvain became rigid, and emitted her message in little short sentences of extreme intensity.
"Who has Cassandra gone out with? William Rodney. Who has Catherine gone out with? Ralph Denham. Why are they forever meeting each other round street corners and going to music halls and taking cabs late at night? Why will Catherine not tell me the truth when I question her? I understand the reason now. Catherine has entangled herself with this unknown lawyer. She has seen fit to condone Cassandra's conduct."
There was another slight pause.
"Ah, well, Catherine will no doubt have some explanation to give me," Mr. Hilbury replied imperturbably. "It's a little too complicated for me to take in all at once, I confess. And if you won't think me rude, Celia, I think I'll be getting along towards Knightsbridge."
Mrs. Milvain rose at once.
"She has condoned Cassandra's conduct and entangled herself with Ralph Denham," she repeated. She stood very erect with the dauntless air of one testifying to the truth regardless of consequences. She knew from past discussions that the only way to counter her brother's indolence and indifference was to shoot her statements at him in a compressed form once finally upon leaving the room. Having spoken thus, she restrained herself from adding another word and left the house with the dignity of one inspired by a great ideal. She had certainly framed her remarks in such a way as to prevent her brother from paying his call in the region of Knightsbridge. He had no fears for Catherine, but there was a suspicion at the back of his mind that Cassandra might have been innocently and ignorantly led into some foolish situation in one of their unshepherded dissipations. His wife was an erratic judge of the conventions. He himself was lazy, and with Catherine absorbed very naturally, here he recalled as well as he could the nature of the charge. She has condoned Cassandra's conduct and entangled herself with Ralph Denham. From which it appeared that Catherine was not absorbed. Or which of them was it that had entangled herself with Ralph Denham? From this maze of absurdity, Mr. Hilbury saw no way out until Catherine herself came to his help. So he applied himself, very philosophically, on the whole, to a book. No sooner had he heard the young people come in and go upstairs than he sent a maid to tell Miss Catherine that he wished to speak to her in the study. She was slipping furs loosely onto the floor in the drawing-room in front of the fire. They were all gathered round, reluctant to part. The message from her father surprised Catherine, and the others caught from her look, as she turned to go, a vague sense of apprehension. Mr. Hilbury was reassured by the sight of her. He congratulated himself, he prided himself, upon possessing a daughter who had a sense of responsibility and an understanding of life profound beyond her years. Moreover, she was looking today unusual. He had come to take her beauty for granted. Now he remembered it and was surprised by it. He thought instinctively that he had interrupted some happy hour of hers with Rodney, and apologized.
"I'm sorry to bother you, my dear. I heard you come in, and thought I'd better make myself disagreeable at once, as it seems, unfortunately, that fathers are expected to make themselves disagreeable. Now, your Aunt Celia has been to see me. Your Aunt Celia has taken it into her head, apparently, that you and Cassandra have been, let us say, a little foolish. This going about together, these pleasant little parties, there has been some kind of misunderstanding. I told her I saw no harm in it, but I should just like to hear from yourself. Has Cassandra been left a little too much in the company of Mr. Denham?"
Catherine did not reply at once, and Mr. Hilbury tapped the coal encouragingly with the poker. Then she said, without embarrassment or apology,
"I don't see why I should answer Aunt Celia's questions. I've told her already that I won't."
Mr. Hilbury was relieved and secretly amused at the thought of the interview, although he could not license such irreverence outwardly.
Very good. Then you authorize me to tell her that she's been mistaken, and there's nothing but a little fun in it. You've no doubt, Catherine, in your own mind. Cassandra is in our charge, and I don't intend that people should gossip about her. I suggest that you should be a little more careful in the future. Invite me to your next entertainment. She did not respond, as he had hoped, with any affectionate or humorous reply. She meditated, pondering something or other, and he reflected that even his Catherine did not differ from other women in the capacity to let things be. Or had she something to say? "Have you a guilty conscience?" he inquired lightly. "Tell me, Catherine," he said more seriously, struck by something in the expression of her eyes. "I've been meaning to tell you for some time," she said. "I'm not going to marry William."
"You're not going," he exclaimed, dropping the poker in his immense surprise. "Why? When? Explain yourself, Catherine."
"Oh, some time ago, a week, perhaps more." Catherine spoke hurriedly and indifferently, as if the matter could no longer concern anyone.
"But may I ask, why have I not been told of this? What do you mean by it?"
"We don't wish to be married, that's all."
"This is William's wish, as well as yours?"
"Oh yes, we agree perfectly." Mr. Hilbury had seldom felt more completely at a loss. He thought that Catherine was treating the matter with curious unconcern. She scarcely seemed aware of the gravity of what she was saying. He did not understand the position at all, but his desire to smooth everything over comfortably came to his relief. No doubt there was some quarrel, some whimsy on the part of William, who, though a good fellow, was a little exacting sometimes, something that a woman could put right. But though he inclined to take the easiest view of his responsibilities, he cared too much for his daughter to let things be.
"I confess I find great difficulty in following you. I should like to hear William's side of the story," he said irritably. "I think he ought to have spoken to me in the first instance."
"I wouldn't let him," said Catherine. "I know it must seem to you very strange," she added, "but I assure you, if you'd wait a little until Mother comes back." This appeal for delay was much to Mr. Hilbury's liking, but his conscience would not suffer it. People were talking. He could not endure that his daughter's conduct should be in any way considered irregular. He wondered whether, in the circumstances, it would be better to wire to his wife, to send for one of his sisters, to forbid William the house, to pack Cassandra off home, for he was vaguely conscious of responsibilities in her direction, too. His forehead was becoming more and more wrinkled by the multiplicity of his anxieties, which he was sorely tempted to ask Catherine to solve for him, when the door opened and William Rodney appeared. This necessitated a complete change, not only of manner, but of position also. "Here's William," Catherine exclaimed in a tone of relief. "I've told Father we're not engaged," she said to him. "I've explained that I prevented you from telling him." William's manner was marked by the utmost formality. He bowed very slightly in the direction of Mr. Hilbury, and stood erect, holding one lapel of his coat, and gazing into the center of the fire. He waited for Mr. Hilbury to speak. Mr. Hilbury also assumed an appearance of formidable dignity. He had risen to his feet, and now bent the top part of his body slightly forward.
"I should like your account of this affair, Rodney, if Catherine no longer prevents you from speaking."
William waited 2 seconds, at least.
"Our engagement is at an end," he said with the utmost stiffness.
"Has this been arrived at by your joint desire?"
After a perceptible pause, William bent his head, and Catherine said, as if by an afterthought, "Oh, yes." Mr. Hilbury swayed to and fro, and moved his lips as if to utter remarks which remained unspoken.
"I can only suggest that you should postpone any decision until the effect of this misunderstanding has had time to wear off. You have now known each other," he began.
"There's been no misunderstanding," Catherine interposed. "Nothing at all." She moved a few paces across the room, as if she intended to leave them. Her preoccupied naturalness was in strange contrast to her father's pomposity, and to William's military rigidity. He had not once raised his eyes. Catherine's glance, on the other hand, ranged past the two gentlemen, along the books, over the tables, towards the door. She was paying the least possible attention, it seemed, to what was happening. Her father looked at her with a sudden clouding and troubling of his expression. Somehow his faith in her stability and sense was queerly shaken. He no longer felt that he could ultimately entrust her with the whole conduct of her own affairs, after a superficial show of directing them. He felt, for the first time in many years, responsible for her.
"Look here, we must get to the bottom of this," he said, dropping his formal manner and addressing Rodney as if Catherine were not present. "You've had some difference of opinion, eh? Take my word for it. Most people go through this sort of thing when they're engaged. I've seen more trouble come from long engagements than from any other form of human folly. Take my advice and put the whole matter out of your minds, both of you. I prescribe a complete abstinence from emotion. Visit some cheerful seaside resort, Rodney."
He was struck by William's appearance, which seemed to him to indicate profound feeling resolutely held in check. No doubt, he reflected, Catherine had been very trying, unconsciously trying, and had driven him to take up a position which was none of his willing. Mr. Hilbury certainly did not overrate William's sufferings. No minutes in his life had hitherto extorted from him such intensity of anguish. He was now facing the consequences of his insanity. He must confess himself entirely and fundamentally other than Mr. Hilbury thought him. Everything was against him. Even the Sunday evening and the fire and the tranquil library scene were against him. Mr. Hilbury's appeal to him as a man of the world was terribly against him. He was no longer a man of any world that Mr. Hilbury cared to recognize. But some power compelled him, as it had compelled him to come downstairs, to make his stand here and now, alone and unhelped by anyone, without prospect of reward. He fumbled with various phrases, and then jerked out, "I love Cassandra." Mr. Hilbury's face turned a curious dull purple. He looked at his daughter. He nodded his head as if to convey his silent command to her to leave the room, but either she did not notice it or preferred not to obey. "You have the impudence," Mr. Hilbury began, in a dull, low voice that he himself had never heard before. When there was a scuffling and exclaiming in the hall, and Cassandra, who appeared to be insisting against some dissuasion on the part of another, burst into the room. "Uncle Trevor," she exclaimed, "I insist upon telling you the truth." She flung herself between Rodney and her uncle, as if she sought to intercept their blows. As her uncle stood perfectly still, looking very large and imposing, and as nobody spoke, she shrank back a little and looked first at Catherine and then at Rodney. "You must know the truth," she said, a little lamely.
"You have the impudence to tell me this in Catherine's presence?" Mr. Hilbury continued, speaking with complete disregard of Cassandra's interruption. "I am aware, quite aware."
Rodney's words, which were broken in sense, spoken after a pause, and with his eyes upon the ground, nevertheless expressed an astonishing amount of resolution.
"I am quite aware what you must think of me," he brought out, looking Mr. Hilbury directly in the eyes for the first time.
"I could express my views on the subject more fully if we were alone," Mr. Hilbury returned.
"But you forget me," said Catherine.
She moved a little towards Rodney, and her movement seemed to testify mutely to her respect for him and her alliance with him.
"I think William has behaved perfectly rightly, and after all, it is I who am concerned. I and Cassandra."
Cassandra, too, gave an indescribably slight movement which seemed to draw the three of them into alliance together. Catherine's tone and glance made Mr. Hilbury once more feel completely at a loss, and in addition, painfully and angrily obsolete. But in spite of an awful inner hollowness, he was outwardly composed.
"Cassandra and Rodney have a perfect right to settle their own affairs according to their own wishes, but I see no reason why they should do so either in my room or in my house. I wish to be quite clear on this point, however. You are no longer engaged to Rodney."
He paused, and his pause seemed to signify that he was extremely thankful for his daughter's deliverance. Cassandra turned to Catherine, who drew her breath as if to speak and checked herself. Rodney, too, seemed to await some movement on her part. Her father glanced at her as if he half anticipated some further revelation. She remained perfectly silent. In the silence they heard distinctly steps descending the staircase, and Catherine went straight to the door.
"Wait," Mr. Hilbury commanded. "I wish to speak to you alone," he added.
She paused, holding the door ajar.
"I'll come back," she said,
and as she spoke she opened the door and went out. They could hear her immediately speak to someone outside, though the words were inaudible. Mr. Hilbury was left confronting the guilty couple, who remained standing as if they did not accept their dismissal, and the disappearance of Catherine had brought some change into the situation. So in his secret heart Mr. Hilbury felt that it had, for he could not explain his daughter's behavior to his own satisfaction. "Uncle Trevor," Cassandra exclaimed impulsively, "don't be angry, please. I couldn't help it. I do beg you to forgive me." Her uncle still refused to acknowledge her identity and still talked over her head as if she did not exist.
"I suppose you have communicated with the Otways," he said to Rodney grimly.
"Uncle Trevor, we wanted to tell you," Cassandra replied for him. "We waited." She looked appealingly at Rodney, who shook his head ever so slightly.
"Yes, what were you waiting for?"
her uncle asked sharply, looking at her at last.
The words died on her lips. It was apparent that she was straining her ears as if to catch some sound outside the room that would come to her help. He received no answer.
He listened, too.
"This is a most unpleasant business for all parties," he concluded, sinking into his chair again, hunching his shoulders, and regarding the flames. He seemed to speak to himself, and Rodney and Cassandra looked at him in silence.
"Why don't you sit down?" he said suddenly. He spoke gruffly, but the force of his anger was evidently spent, or some preoccupation had turned his mood to other regions. While Cassandra accepted his invitation, Rodney remained standing.
"I think Cassandra can explain matters better in my absence," he said, and left the room,
Mr. Hillbury giving his assent by a slight nod of the head. Meanwhile, in the dining room next door, Denham and Catherine were once more seated at the mahogany table. They seemed to be continuing a conversation broken off in the middle, as if each remembered the precise point at which they had been interrupted, and was eager to go on as quickly as possible. Catherine, having interposed a short account of the interview with her father, Denham made no comment, but said,
"Anyhow, there's no reason why we shouldn't see each other."
"Or stay together. It's only marriage that's out of the question," Catherine replied.
"But if I find myself coming to want you more and more?"
"If our lapses come more and more often?"
He sighed impatiently and said nothing for a moment.
"But at least," he renewed, "we have established the fact that my lapses are still in some odd way connected with you. Yours have nothing to do with me.
Catherine," he added, his assumption of reason broken up by his agitation,
"I assure you that we are in love, what other people call love. Remember that night. We had no doubts whatever then. We were absolutely happy for half an hour. You had no lapse until the day after. I had no lapse until yesterday morning. We've been happy at intervals all day until I went off my head, and you, quite naturally, were bored."
"Ah," she exclaimed, as if the subject chafed her.
"I can't make you understand. It's not boredom. I'm never bored. Reality. Reality," she ejaculated, tapping her finger upon the table, as if to emphasize and perhaps explain her isolated utterance of this word.
"I cease to be real to you. It's the faces in a storm again, the vision in a hurricane. We come together for a moment and we part. It's my fault, too. I'm as bad as you are. Worse, perhaps."
They were trying to explain, not for the first time, as their weary gestures and frequent interruptions showed, what in their common language they had christened their lapses, a constant source of distress to them in the past few days, and the immediate reason why Ralph was on his way to leave the house when Catherine, listening anxiously, heard him and prevented him. What was the cause of these lapses? Either because Catherine looked more beautiful or more strange, because she wore something different or said something unexpected, Ralph's sense of her romance welled up and overcame him, either into silence or into inarticulate expressions, which Catherine, with unintentional but invariable perversity, interrupted or contradicted with some severity or assertion of prosaic fact. Then the vision disappeared, and Ralph expressed vehemently in his turn the conviction that he only loved her shadow and cared nothing for her reality. If the lapse was on her side, it took the form of gradual detachment until she became completely absorbed in her own thoughts, which carried her away with such intensity that she sharply resented any recall to her companion's side. It was useless to assert that these trances were always originated by Ralph himself, however little in their later stages they had to do with him. The fact remained that she had no need of him and was very loath to be reminded of him. How then could they be in love? The fragmentary nature of their relationship was but too apparent. Thus they sat depressed to silence at the dining room table, oblivious of everything, while Rodney paced the drawing room overhead in such agitation and exaltation of mind as he had never conceived possible, and Cassandra remained alone with her uncle. Ralph at length rose and walked gloomily to the window.
He pressed close to the pane. Outside were truth and freedom, and the immensity only to be apprehended by the mind in loneliness, and never communicated to another. What worse sacrilege was there than to attempt to violate what he perceived by seeking to impart it? Some movement behind him made him reflect that Catherine had the power, if she chose, to be in person what he dreamt of her spirit. He turned sharply to implore her help, when again he was struck cold by her look of distance, her expression of intentness upon some far object. As if conscious of his look upon her, she rose and came to him, standing close by his side, and looking with him out into the dusky atmosphere. Their physical closeness was to him a bitter enough comment upon the distance between their minds. Yet distant as she was, her presence by his side transformed the world. He saw himself performing wonderful deeds of courage, saving the drowning, rescuing the forlorn. Impatient with this form of egotism, he could not shake off the conviction that somehow life was wonderful, romantic, a master worth serving so long as she stood there. He had no wish that she should speak. He did not look at her or touch her. She was apparently deep in her own thoughts and oblivious of his presence. The door opened without their hearing the sound. Mr. Hilbury looked round the room and for a moment failed to discover the two figures in the window. He started with displeasure when he saw them, and observed them keenly before he appeared able to make up his mind to say anything. He made a movement, finally, that warned them of his presence. They turned instantly. Without speaking, he beckoned to Catherine to come to him, and keeping his eyes from the region of the room where Denham stood, he shepherded her in front of him back to the study. When Catherine was inside the room, he shut the door carefully behind him, as if to secure himself from something that he disliked. "Now, Catherine," he said, taking up his stand in front of the fire, "you will, perhaps, have the kindness to explain." She remained silent. "What inferences do you expect me to draw?" he said sharply. "You tell me that you are not engaged to Rodney. I see you on what appear to be extremely intimate terms with another, with Ralph Denham. What am I to conclude? Are you," he added as she still said nothing, "engaged to Ralph Denham?" "No," she replied. His sense of relief was great. He had been certain that her answer would have confirmed his suspicions, but that anxiety being set at rest, he was the more conscious of annoyance with her for her behavior. "Then all I can say is that you've very strange ideas of the proper way to behave. People have drawn certain conclusions, nor am I surprised. The more I think of it, the more inexplicable I find it," he went on, his anger rising as he spoke. "Why am I left in ignorance of what is going on in my own house? Why am I left to hear of these events for the first time from my sister? Most disagreeable, most upsetting. How am I to explain to your Uncle Francis? But I wash my hands of it. Cassandra goes tomorrow. I forbid Rodney the house. As for the other young man, the sooner he makes himself scarce, the better. After placing the most implicit trust in you, Catherine," he broke off, disquieted by the ominous silence with which his words were received, and looked at his daughter with a curious doubt as to her state of mind, which he had felt before, for the first time this evening. He perceived once more that she was not attending to what he said, but was listening, and for a moment he, too, listened for sounds outside the room. His certainty that there was some understanding between Denham and Catherine returned, but with a most unpleasant suspicion that there was something illicit about it, as the whole position between the young people seemed to him gravely illicit. "I'll speak to Denham," he said, on the impulse of his suspicion, moving as if to go. "I shall come with you," Catherine said instantly, starting forward. "You will stay here," said her father. "What are you going to say to him?" she asked. "I suppose I may say what I like in my own house," he returned. "Then I go, too," she replied. At these words, which seemed to imply a determination to go forever, Mr. Hilbury returned to his position in front of the fire, and began swaying slightly from side to side, without for the moment making any remark. "I understood you to say that you were not engaged to him," he said at length, fixing his eyes upon his daughter. "We are not engaged," she said. "It should be a matter of indifference to you, then, whether he comes here or not. I will not have you listening to other things when I am speaking to you," he broke off angrily, perceiving a slight movement on her part to one side. "Answer me frankly. What is your relationship with this young man?"
"Nothing that I can explain to a third person," she said obstinately.
"I will have no more of these equivocations," he replied.
"I refuse to explain," she returned,
and as she said it, the front door banged to. "There!" she exclaimed. "He is gone!" She flashed such a look of fiery indignation at her father that he lost his self-control for a moment.
"For God's sake, Catherine, control yourself!" he cried.
She looked for a moment like a wild animal caged in a civilized dwelling place. She glanced over the walls covered with books, as if for a second she had forgotten the position of the door. Then she made as if to go, but her father laid his hand upon her shoulder. He compelled her to sit down. "These emotions have been very upsetting, naturally," he said. His manner had regained all of its suavity, and he spoke with a soothing assumption of parental authority. "You've been placed in a very difficult position, as I understand from Cassandra. Now let us come to terms. We will leave these agitating questions in peace for the present. Meanwhile, let us try to behave like civilized beings. Let us read Sir Walter Scott. What do you say to The Antiquary, eh? Or The Bride of Lammermoor?" He made his own choice, and before his daughter could protest or make her escape, she found herself being turned by the agency of Sir Walter Scott into a civilized human being. Yet Mr. Hilbury had grave doubts, as he read, whether the process was more than skin-deep. Civilization had been very profoundly and unpleasantly overthrown that evening. The extent of the ruin was still undetermined. He had lost his temper, a physical disaster not to be matched for the space of 10 years or so, and his own condition urgently required soothing and renovating at the hands of the classics. His house was in a state of revolution. He had a vision of unpleasant encounters on the staircase. His meals would be poisoned for days to come. Was literature itself a specific against such disagreeables? A note of hollowness was in his voice as he read. End of chapter 32.